Next item on the agenda, public hearing, proposed amendments to Regulation 4, BAC 27-2010, pertaining to restrictions on oyster harvest. To open to oyster harvest certain parts of the Lower Rappahannock River and Virginia tributaries of Potomac River. Dr. Wesson, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. The last letters have come in.
I think we've got these maybe ready. I'm not sure.
Okay. Public comment period last month. Industry asked again to open the Lower Rappahannock and tributaries of the Potomac. We've had public hearings on this several times before. Staff remains opposed to opening the Lower Rappahannock closed area, as well as opening the areas in the Potomac tributaries that are now closed. Just to review where we are, we had unusually high oyster harvest in 2004 and 2005 because of some unique environmental conditions. Many harvesters entered the fishery that hadn't been in the fishery for a long time or hadn't been in the fishery at all. And now in 2006, we've gone back to environmental conditions that are more similar to what we've been used to for the recent history, where the salinities are high enough, the diseases have had an impact this year. We've also had very low spat sets during the years of survival in 2003, 4, and 5. So we're left in a situation where we have much lower quantities of oysters in 2006 with more harvests than we had before. 2007 doesn't look any better, and it's likely because we've only had a moderate spat set in 2006 that you won't see anything like we had in 2004 and 5, at least out beyond 2008. The sanctuary areas that we're now, they're under consideration for opening are, they protect brood stock and hopefully provide spawn that will maintain some harvest, much lower than what we want, but at least something that we can count on for the future. If we run through the Rappahannock first, just to briefly go through all the issues that are in your briefing. We had a request to open all the river, along with a request to open this area, which is the southern side of the river, down to the red buoy marked on that NOAA chart, into about Broad Creek, and then back to the bridge. At the Blue Room panel, we had another potential opening that was considered, and that's picking up at Mosquito Point, going to the buoy at Sturgeon Bar, and then coming into the shore somewhere. We just brought it in at the mouth of Sturgeon Creek. This area, the Rappahannock River, we began restoration in this with the Virginia Oyster Heritage Program in 1999. And you can see in this phase one and phase two. Phase one was started in 1999 when a bunch of partners got together. We combined our sister agency, DEQ, that working through NOAA funds with the Corps of Engineers, with the EPA Chesapeake Bay Program, with our funds. We had recreational fishing money, and then money from NGOs and a lot of help from industry. And the partners came together to work in a bigger river than we had worked in before, to see if by setting up a series of three-dimensional sanctuaries intermixed with restoration of two-dimensional harvest areas, if we could restore our system back to get some sustainability in harvest. Large financial investment in this. NOAA alone has put more than $6 million in it. The Corps, a little bit over $1 million. We've put a lot of money in it. It's a very large project, the largest one we had ever done to that time. In 2001 and 2002, we were in the midst of a drought, and the harvests were as low as we had seen in the bay for oysters. And the partnership, the Oyster Heritage Program, had intended to start this system, follow it for a while, and eventually set triggers on how the areas would be reopened. But because it was such a dire situation, the commission decided to open parts of the river that were premature in relation to what the partnership had envisioned. So we never got to a point of ever setting any kind of triggers, but they decided to open from that Route 3 bridge up to that first black line, because that's as far as we were in 2002. We started opening one side, then we opened the other side, and the argument from the industry was that if we open these to hand scrapes, and if we work these areas, that it would actually be better for the areas than if we left them alone. And we began following at that time the differences between below the bridge and above the bridge. At this point, the partnership was kind of backed into a corner, and we still, the partnership still remains committed to the fact that if where we are now is that the sanctuary is on one side of the bridge and the open air is on the other, that the partnership would at least like to see it remain that way. The second issue that we have in this is that there's a density issue that has come from doing the monitoring. And it's the differences between harvesting and not harvesting. Put these graphs on the same page this time so you can see them better. But really what we're looking for is what we want to see is the red, which is the market-sized oysters, increasing the quantities enough that we start getting some density effects. Density is absolutely critical to oyster fertilization. The two things that oysters need are large oysters, because the bigger an oyster, the more sperm or egg they have, it's just a bigger, larger fecundity potential, and being close to one another, so the densities have to increase. What we have seen is that in the unharvested area, that there's two times more oysters density than in the harvested area. There are also more clusters of big oysters that have higher densities than in the unharvested area. This is not nearly the number of oysters that we would like to see, obviously. I mean, we're always talking about getting about to 3 oysters per meter as an average. But with oysters, they're not like crabs and fish and other things that we manage. I mean, when you get low densities of crabs or fish, at least the male and female can find one another. Even in low densities. For oysters, they're stuck with where they are, and the only way they can maintain densities is to be allowed to accumulate in those densities and left alone. And that's the only thing that we can do as managers to at least give us higher chances of fertilization amongst the oysters that are there. We have seen a spat set in 2006 that you can see from the green. It is higher on one side than the other. It's kind of artificially, I actually broke it down this time so you can see it, where the spat set is. The in no harvest and in harvest means the north side of the river. And so basically, except for the north side of the river in the harvested area, everywhere was just a low, moderate set. That one area actually had a higher set, and it's an area that's always historically had a higher set, and don't really understand that, but the northern part of that area right above Carter's Creek has always gotten a higher spat set than the other areas. So it seems like something that we're doing in the management here has given us that set, because it is higher than in a lot of areas that we saw in the bay this year. The second issue on the difference between harvested and unharvested is that there's always been this question on working the bottom and whether if dredges are pulled on the bottom and they pull the shells out of the water, out of the bottom, and that somehow is like tilling a farm and making the area more conducive to oyster survival and spat set. This argument was made in 1993 and during the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel meetings that we had in the early 90s. And we had it a lot of times during the debates over closing the bay, a lot of the bay to harvest in the early 90s. And because of that, our program worked with VIMS in the mid-90s to actually do tests on that subject. And you really can't do the test very well by just opening in an area and have two areas that are quite different geographically to see if there are differences in spatset from working. We actually took areas in rivers that we saw spatsets more regularly, like the Great Wicomico and the Piangtang, and we divided bars up into quarters, randomly picked the corner, the different sections, and on one section we put fresh shell, one section we did nothing, the other section we hired watermen to bagless dredge. And the difference between bagless dredge and harvesting is that you take the bag off the dredge and you don't actually pick the shells up into the boat. But it was done at the correct time of the year, which is an important part of trying to study this. If you want to try to help pull shells out at the right time, you want to do it in the summer around when spatsets occurring and larvae is in the water. When we did these tests, we did them for 2 years. The only thing that we were able to determine was that always our freshly planted shells were the best. There was never any difference between the bagless dredge area and the area that was left alone. When you talk about doing it just in the wintertime during the normal harvest season, it's entirely different than that because you're talking about pulling up shells now. And between now and July, when spatset occurs, most of the shells that would be pulled up now would actually go back in the sediment and it would be refouled. We further checked another issue that's involved in this reharvesting by taking shells that were old shells that were in the water, actually putting them in buckets and keeping them in water so that we could transport them to the hatchery so that we would not lose any of the fouling organisms that were on the old shells on the bottom. Took them into the hatchery and put them in tanks with oyster larvae with the old shell and fresh shell. And in all cases, it was at least 10 times. Sometimes it was more than 10 times more larvae attached to a fresh shell than to an old shell. And that's the basis of why we do shell planting in the replenishment program. I mean, fresh shells are better. Oysters, if given a choice, they want to attach to a fresh shell or to a live oyster. That's where the shells are in the best condition for them to attach to. Maryland has done similar tests on bagless dredging and on areas harvest versus not harvest, and no study that's been done so far has been able to detect a difference that's significant between harvested and non-harvested area or bagless dredge and not bagless dredge. And when you look out this year, you look in what we saw in our fall survey, if you run right down from right out here in the lower James where we had harvest for 2004 and 2005, we had 6 months of harvest in both of those areas, very intensive harvest. Biggest part of our catch was right down here. We didn't see a difference in that harvested area. We actually saw low spatsets out there during the harvest, and when we checked in 2004, 2005, and now again in 2006. When we look out in the James River this year, doesn't seem any rhyme or reason to where the spatset actually occurred. But it is definitely not related to the difference between a harvested area and a non-harvested area. Above that area in the Rappahannock, above the area that we're talking about now where that black line was in the phase two that we're now working on, there wasn't any spatset there, and that's been dredged heavily. The only two areas that we saw significant spatset this year in the bay that we haven't done everywhere yet, but we have a good spatset in the Great Wicomico and a good spatset in the Piangtang, both areas that haven't been harvested in several years. So it's very hard to attach any sort of connection between harvest and spatset. The third issue that we have to consider and open this area is just the issue of disease tolerance. Oysters are constantly subjected to the two diseases that we have in the bay. The diseases kill the oysters when they're less than 3 years old. The most intense pressure is on that 2 to 3 inch oyster, 2 to 3 years old. Oysters don't have any way to signal us, so we can look at them and tell which oyster has resistance and which oyster doesn't have resistance. There's no physical difference in the oysters on the one that survive and don't survive. At least for, in an evolutionary sense, you think that if you survive and you get larger than 3 inches, that possibly you have some resistance. If there was any oyster that we would want to keep as available in brood stock, that would be the oyster, because we would hope that that would be what would be passed on to their offspring. The harvesting process actually short-circuits that evolutionary process, because you're taking the 3-inch oysters, you're taking the survivors, you're not letting them see whether they get to be a bigger size and have some resistance. And it's only by the fact of leaving these areas alone that you can actually get into these 4, 5, and 6 year periods where you can get into the 5 and 6 inch oysters. And an interesting piece of information that has just started to come up now and that Vims may speak to in a little bit is that we are seeing in the Rappahannock, and we see in some of the other rivers also, that gives us pause for not keeping, allowing sanctuaries to be open, is that it appears that the intensity of disease in oysters that have gone beyond this high disease pressure period of 2 to 3 inches, 2 to 3 years, and they get into those bigger sizes, we actually see in the disease test that the intensity of disease decreases in the bigger animals. Whether that's an indication of tolerance, we don't know at this point, but it certainly is a suggestion, and it's something that, if at all possible, I mean, if we have any management strategy that we're trying to do right now with a very sick animal, is to try to keep some of these animals in that incubator of producing an animal that is stronger under the conditions of disease that we have. The last issue is the issue that came up at the last meeting on what we don't know, and that's the issue of circulation. For the Rappahannock, we only have a modest understanding of the circulation of the larvae. But the confusing thing, the hard thing about trying to understand spat set is that we think we have a relatively good understanding of circulation in the James and in the Great Wicomico. In the James this year, there seems to be no rhyme or reason at all of where was a good set area and what was a bad set area. There seemed like one side of the river was a little bit better in some areas, other side was better in other areas of the river. The Great Wicomico, where we have a big experiment going out right now where we have actually genetically marked animals that are placed on a reef that we think is in the gyre that takes the larvae, and we had a very large spat set this year. The actual numbers of animals that we can detect is coming from the orchards that we put there is very, very small. I mean, down in the 1% to 2%. We didn't think there was enough oysters out in the Great Wicomico because the numbers had gotten so large to actually result in a set like this. So we don't understand the circulation of Rappahannock very well, but in areas that we understand very well, we still can't predict the timing or the amount of the spat set. I mean, we can look back in hindsight and say this is probably what it was for, but it's very hard to predict. All we know from looking out in the Rappahannock is that we're getting a spat set, so something seems to be working at least enough to try to maintain the meager fishery that we have out there. So at least for the Rappahannock, it doesn't seem to be any biological reason that we can see at this point to change the management strategy that we have. We don't have a better strategy. We are interested in, and at this point, getting the partners back together of the Horseshoe Heritage Program and to see if we could sit down and rearrange the sanctuaries. But from what we've learned in the past 5 or 6 years, it seems like we know for certain the little one-acre sanctuaries are not enough to carry the weight that we thought they would be able to carry when we set all this up. And so we need relatively large areas of sanctuary. And if we rearrange the Rappahannock, there's still going to be about the same number of areas that are set aside as sanctuary as we have now. It's just that we may rearrange it so that there's areas open in all parts of the river. Just to show one little tidbit of information that is a confusing part or an additional piece of information is just what they've seen in the Potomac River over time. The Potomac is very similar if you look at the way it flows and everything to the Rappahannock. Big Flushing River. You look way back in the 60s and they had, 600,000 bushels of horses coming out of that one river. 72 and 73, when everything went down so quickly, that was Hurricane Agnes. That had a big die-off from freshwater. And then it came back up and they maintained harvests in the 100,000s and disease started getting into the picture. And you can look at where the harvest has gone in the Potomac. And in the Potomac, they've never done sanctuaries. They've never done any sort of setting areas aside. And there's almost nothing there to be caught right now, which kind of is an indication of maybe something we're doing in the Rappahannock is working. And it also speaks to the other issue that we have of asking to open the Potomac tributaries up, the Virginia Potomac tributaries up for harvest. We had them open last year to hand scrapes. Everybody worked there and quit after several weeks and left it as it was. We hadn't had a spat set in 2003, 2004, 2005. And so this year, we only opened up the area that we'd actually moved seed into. There are small areas up the tributaries, farther up tributaries in the areas that we've had open that we have left alone. They have the same small accumulations of large old animals in higher densities than other places. And in 2006, we have now seen at least a reasonable spat set in the Cone and the Ucomico rivers, the two most eastward rivers there. And if you go into the Potomac, they saw only one spat in their fall survey from the Cone all the way to the 301 bridge. So it would seem that all the arguments that we have that we have used for the Rappahannock, we also think apply in these small areas in the Potomac Tribs that have remained closed. We think they are the only hope of any sort of natural reproduction occurring in these tributaries, that at some point we can supplement with seed, but we can't get to all of them every year. We don't really have a good seed program right now. We're working on getting a better seed program through a spat on shale program that gives us some rate protection, but at least where we are right now, in order to try to maintain some modest fishery, this seems that the only two goals that we can have in management right now is just trying to maintain a little fishery and trying to leave some large orchards alone, develop disease tolerance, and have them in aggregations enough that their offspring can then add populations of stronger animals to the areas that we're harvesting. So are there any questions?
Mr. Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Watson, I have one question. In your recommendations, you've spoken to the issue of redesigning the sanctuary system in the Rappahannock.
At least, yeah, having the partners get together to see if that's a possibility.
Right.
If we can come up with a better design than we have now.
Right, and it seems that the results speak to that, certainly. But my question is one of timing. Is that something that could be done, in your estimation, over the next 6 months, such that we could have a an understanding prior to the
Yeah,
next
but we would like, I mean, I talked to, actually DEQ was the lead on the Oyster Heritage Program, and I've already asked them, you know, could we have a meeting very soon to actually see if we could come up with something that could be presented to the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel to see if that would, you know, enter into their discussions. And it wouldn't take away from the time of the Blue Ribbon Panel if they had something that they could actually consider in there as opposed to doing the debates in that group.
Mr. Tankard?
I have two questions. One, you mentioned as issue one that the partners came together in the Oyster Heritage Program, and you mentioned $6 million, $1 million, and some other various amounts. How much did that really come to, Dr. Wesson? Do you guesstimate?
Well, probably $8 or $9 million, and, you know, the unfortunate thing is the only thing we have to show for that is these few large old oysters in the mouth of the river, along with the modest harvest that we have had. And we have been able to maintain pretty much an average of 6 to 8 thousand bushels of harvest on these on this area in the Rappahannock each year. So.
And my follow-up question is: was it the intention that this area be left undisturbed because of that type of large investment by the partners who involved in the Heritage Program?
The intention was that it would have been left undisturbed for a longer period than it was when we started on it, but. We hadn't even gotten to the point. We were still in the building phase. We were building right through 2004, so we were still in the building phase of in 2002 when it got opened. So.
Okay. In your estimation, how many oysters, if we allow the harvest in first in the Rappahannock and then the tribs of the Potomac, how many oysters are down there that to be caught, approximately?
Well,
in other words, what's the economic gain that could be
in the Potomac tribs? Multiple hundreds of bushels, at the most, several hundred.
500.
In the Lower Rappahannock, the year that we opened. Brand new, the area above the bridge, we had 13,000. And this would be talking about a shorter season, so I think 10,000 would be the outside maximum.
All right, and at market value?
$30,
$35 would be the revenues from that.
Right. Only the initial revenue. There are always multipliers through all the shuckinghouses and everything.
Right,
so
to the watermen themselves.
$350,000.
But the waterman has to put fuel in his boat, and it costs him money. So he's not going to make $30 a bushel.
Right.
He's going to have some cost. Do you have any guess as to what that cost might be?
No, but obviously with fuel, it's significant. But if you had an 8-bushel limit, you know, it's a normal daily cost that they have, maybe $20 or $30 per day.
Uh-huh.
For the fuel.
Well, I think one observation here, and it goes to the point somebody made down there, I think Ed. Looks like we've put in the Rappahannock, we've put $8 to $9 million worth of investment in there, and we have about $300,000 worth of oysters. Which demonstrates to me that the process, the program we've got going is really not working very well. But I think that's because the oyster itself is in such bad shape.
That's obviously why we're considering another
right.
oyster.
Right. And so I'm troubled it seems to me we're in a very bad situation, and the level of hope should be quite low. We're on a very long-term fix here if we want to see the Virginia Coalition.
That's right.
Back again. Now, aquaculture is a different role, and a different species of oysters is a different issue also.
That's right.
Those represent opportunities, it seems to me.
Dr. McConaughey?
Yeah, I just had a couple of questions. Just get an idea of what we're trying to go for. You said the density is about 3 per meter. What would you consider that we need to have to get 70-80% fertilization?
We haven't sat down as a group of a manager and scientist to get to that point. I mean, it's one thing that we need to do. I mean, it's we have a lot of information from other rivers, like the James River, where densities in the James River, where we see spatset routinely, we're talking about beds that have 300 per meter or more.
So, I mean, yeah, there's
the disparity is gigantic.
Yeah. Somebody should look at the sea urchin fertilization data. There's a lot of information on that kind of fertilization. And just a comment, you were surprised that you got 1% or 2% return from your genetically tagged oysters. And an invertebrate, that's significant. I wouldn't have expected it to be that high. I would expect it to be much lower. So I think that's probably a good set at 1% or 2%.
Mr. Tankard.
My question was more along the lines of not funds being squandered relative to the value of the oysters to watermen, but it was really, it seems to me this is an investment for watermen's future, for the oysters' future, and that's that investment, in my mind, is $8 or $9 million worth of investments that the state and its partners have put together to try to help this industry out. And I think there's a market value, but I think there's an investment for the future value that Dr. Wesson speaks to. And so I meant that the money had been squandered.
Thank you, Mr. Tankard. Mr. Bowden?
I want to ask you a question, but I want to address something, too, because we were talking about this $9 million. I don't want people to think that $9 million went overboard up there. A lot of that's went into the scientific community. They've been spending it in universities and other places. We don't really have a on the bottom.
Well, yeah, that's what I gave you is on the bottom. I'm not
just
talking
on the bottom.
I'm talking about
just anything else. All right.
I'm not talking about one penny.
Thanks for that clarification. Can you give me an idea of the size difference between the harvest area and the non-harvest area? Is the harvest area twice as big? Half as big?
You mean the size of what? The actual.
The actual rock shelf. I mean, the oyster producing area below the bridge compared to the.
About the same.
They're about the same. And you have a twofold difference in mature oysters, roughly.
In density
of mature
per
oysters.
Meter.
But yet, you've probably taken how many out above the bridge of mature market oysters?
Well, we've been taking about 5,000 to 8,000 bushels a year times 300.
It's a substantial difference. So evidently above the bridge has been where the production has really occurred.
Well, that's where the only place we've got any production, and actually it's a very important part of the fact that these orchards are living long enough to make it to harvest size.
Above the bridge are living as just as well as they are below the bridge, evidently better because you've had harvest up there. And there's only a twofold difference between the areas that wasn't harvest.
There's one wild card that's in the Rappahannock that has made this not as high as we would like to see, and that was in 2003, we had a severe anoxic event in the Rappahannock. And it got all the areas, more of the areas that we monitor were deeper in the below the bridge than above. So that's in there, too, that we lost a lot of the big set that we had, the bigger set that we had in 2001, 2002, the Noxie in 2003. But that was on both sides of the bridge, but it was especially severe below the bridge.
When I was reading through all the information we got, I don't see Dr. Allen here. I would have certainly asked him. He also mentioned in his email that with increased densities, the probability of disease increases also. So we may not be saving as much as we think because of the fact that they are getting closer together, there's more chance for disease killing them.
Well, but the fact is that we've seen the intensity. That is true for the smaller oysters, but the bigger oysters that have possibly gone into this lower intensity phase, those are the ones that we would like to see in higher density.
And what I see from this information, I'm not a scientist, thank the Lord. You get little favors every day, I guess. I won't want your job. What I'm seeing is this.
You want his job?
No, I want. Man, my $50 a day is bad enough. I wouldn't do it his for $1,000. What I'm saying is this. Evidently, a lot of the oysters that were harvested above the bridge would have died.
That's,
or you would have the same difference. I mean, you know, you would have considerably more below the bridge than you have above the bridge. So of those that were harvested, a lot of them would just die to natural mortality due to disease. And when you talk about Oyster Heritage Program, I think what we need to look at, too, is oyster is a heritage of a lot of people, not just the watershed. We have no infrastructure left. When I graduated from high school in 1972, we had 13 shucking houses on the island. Now we have none. There's three local little people that shuck. Two of them are so big, one shucker does both of them. And the other fellow shucks his own. So, you know, we have, and as I know Chincoteague was the largest, don't get me wrong, on the Eastern Shore. But every seaside town and most bayside creeks had at least one shucking house, and sometimes considerably more than that. Do we bring the oysters back at any cost? And I think that's the question we need to look at. Is any cost mean put everybody out of business so when they come back? At least with bald eagles or something, we can watch them. Well, oysters maybe in the middle of the river, you're not going to get much of a tourist business coming out to go oyster watching, I'm afraid.
Well, there's a big EIS being done now that's trying to answer that exact question. Of
I mean, you know, we know right off the bat what we're doing isn't working, and everybody agrees to that. I'm sure all the partners agree to it. Some of the people that sent letters in protest may not, but I think, you know, it's pretty apparent that what we're doing is not very successful. Do I have all the answers? No. I don't think anybody does. But I just can't. I think we could come to some compromise somewhere along the way. I can't agree with Mr. Kellum's proposal last month. I think that was a little large scale for my taste, but I think somewhere along the line we all need to get together, and not only do we want to preserve the oyster because they're very important to everybody, but we also want to preserve the industry, and we're very close to losing what few we got left. I only know of three left on the Western Shore, maybe many more than that, but that's all I know. So I think the Western Shore is following the same fate that the Eastern Shore did, just at a later date, because disease didn't wipe them out as fast as it did home. When I was a young boy, there was over 100 boats working in Chincoteague Bay dredging oysters off of private ground. Now you couldn't go up there in a month's time to dredge enough to eat.
Yeah.
So.
Any other questions, Dr. Wesson? Thank you, Jim. Last month when we started down this path, I asked Virginia Institute of Marine Science to undertake an evaluation of this program as well, and Dr. Mann, if you would be so kind as to present the Virginia Institute of Marine Sciences evaluation, I'd greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Commissioner, members of the Commission, a few opening comments. To you, Commissioner Bowman, I had the pleasure of many years of working with your predecessor. I congratulate you on your appointment. I look forward to many years of working with you, sir.
Thank you, Doctor.
There are two new faces on this commission who have never seen me here before, Mr. Tankard and Dr. McConaughey, who I know. Welcome, gentlemen, again. In my role as Director of Research, you will see me here periodically, and I again hope that we can work together productively. You have in your packets, I hope, a copy of the letter that states the BIM's position on this. It is a letter that was prepared by a group of staff at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, including myself, those who know something about ecology, those who know something about diseases, circulation, and many others. And I can say that probably with the exception of the King William Reservoir letter, I've never seen so much intensity put into a letter in 1 month to try and give you an overview of where we need to be. Commissioner Bowman posed us with three questions. The value of the current sanctuary, the role that it plays in the health of the resource, and its potential value. It's a long letter. I won't read all of it. In the end, the position that we came to is to maintain the position of closure of the region to harvest, to maintain that position. This is done with some considerable trepidation. And in getting to that, I would like not to go through the details of this, but I would like to address three things. One is how we get to this debate that we're having today. One is what you would get if you considered opening this, and the other one is what you would lose if you considered opening this, and try and sort of put those into a perspective. Dr. Wesson spoke about the history of this particular project in the lower part of the Rappahannock. It was essentially initiated by Governor Gilmore with great fanfare that when he announced that we were going to restore the lower Rappahannock, and he did so without asking too many people. But nonetheless, we followed his edict, and what you have seen is a project to which many partners have contributed, to which vast amounts of money have been invested. And before we even sort of got it out of the door and actually developed, first of all, a statement of expectations for each of the partners. I mean, would you invest in something if you didn't know where it was going? And also, without any real sort of close development of a long-term management plan, was this for restoration? Was this for harvest? Was this for some mix of the two? What were the expectations in terms of what we would get out of it in harvest? What would be the triggers for opening it? What would be the triggers for closing it? No such document was ever developed. And I don't say this is a document that the scientists should develop. This is a document that all of the partners, including the industry, should develop. This is all of our money. Here we are, having started this in 1999, it's now the end of 2006. We still don't have a management plan for the Rappahannock. This is not a good way to do things. I say this to you, you already know it. The way in which we manage this is that each year, possibly more than once, someone will come here in a public comment period and propose something to you, and then in 30 days we rush through this process to see if we can find opposing positions. And then we get up here and we verbally spar it out, and you gentlemen are left with the situation of having to vote on it. And at the end of it, what we end up with is a lot of people who dislike each other, and many people dislike me because I represent the scientists. I personally don't like being in that position because I respect a lot of the people who sit behind me, whether they're going to dislike me at the end of this afternoon or not. I've also worked with many of them for many of their years, and I know the plight that they're in. And despite the fact that we will have differing opinions, I still appreciate that. Gentlemen, this is not a way to manage this resource. I do not want to be back here next year with us having the same debate, generating the same levels of animosity, watching the same diversity of opinion expressed across this table. This is not productive. If we continue to invest money, not only in this river and every other river in Virginia as we do this, state money, private nonprofit money, many federal partners, we have to improve the way in which we do this and have a conversation that involves everybody in terms of his expectations. Enough preaching, you all know that. I think we need to do that. Where we sit with this river, and Dr. Wesson has given you, I think, a good example of how, where we sit at this point in time is that we sit at an impasse where we have, on one side, an industry that really is in dire straits. It's not its own fault. This year has been particularly bad in terms of disease. The James is not being productive at this point in time. And many of these gentlemen who are sitting behind me feel this in terms of their wallet, and they're coming to and asking you for some relief. Again, it's being done in this situation where we have no long-term plan as to where we're going, and it's a, let's see if we can do this. I understand their position. On the other side of it, we are here discussing the term sanctuaries. The commissioner, with all due respect, sir, used this term in his letter to the institution. Mr. Wesson has used it. I apologize, Dr. Wesson has used it. To the best of my knowledge, there are no such things as sanctuaries in code. We sort of worked through this, and these areas that we have closed have become de facto sanctuaries when they're not sanctuaries. There's a lot of confusion about precisely what these areas are needing to be. And again, because we have no long-term plan and no expectations, nobody knows where the dickens we're going. We are in a very awkward position where at this point in time, below the bridge, we have somewhere between 5 and 10,000 bushels of large oysters. If you take those, you get some form of economic relief. Certainly this industry needs that economic relief. But what are you going to lose if you take them away? There are two things that you will lose. You will undermine what is left of that original investment, no matter how badly or how well it was planned or how well-intentioned it was planned. You will lose a chunk of that. And that is really important because, for heaven's sake, we do need to get ourselves organized on this. But why in particular these oysters? I must admit that I was a bit ambivalent about this when this question first came out. And I've been out there and I've looked at some of these oysters, and there are some wonderful oysters out there. A significant, in fact, a very large proportion of what you have out there in market oysters is between 4 and 5.5 inches long. If you look at the history of these oysters, they should all be dead. That's extraordinarily important. They should all be dead. Dr. Wesson told you about the diseases. If you look at the history of the lower Rappahannock, this is an area which has traditionally suffered incredibly badly from disease pressure. Incredibly badly. And yet at this point in time, you have a very significant number of very large oysters out there that are minimally 4 or 5 years old, probably 6 years old, and many of them older than that. Why are they there? If you look at this in terms of the size of the age fractionation, these big animals are the healthiest amongst the population, and they are the ones with the lowest disease load in the body. There is clearly something unique about these oysters. They are not dying. Now, the question then before us is, do we look at the investment that we've made, and do we consider this unusual population as being sufficiently unique after all of these years of disease challenge to take that investment and say that we should maintain them and we should keep the area closed? The fundamental question that you have at this point is these particular oysters, which are really quite unique, they're clearly very different from the ones in the James, which are suffering terrible mortalities at this point in time. Clearly very different. Are you willing to take the investment that's been made and preserve these? I think that alone is an argument for maintaining these animals in a closed situation. If you open this, you will lose that. If you open this, you will lose that. That is really the fine balance point that you have at this point in time. I will reiterate that there is some trepidation that I offer this, not because of the science. I think the science is extraordinarily sound. These are unique. But I also think that this is a terrible way to manage this. We should not be in the situation where, effectively on the spur of the moment, once every year, we get into these verbal adversarial situations. This is not a good way to do things. Thank you. I appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Mann. And on behalf of the Commission, I'd like to thank Virginia Institute of Marine Science for undertaking this project on such a short time frame. Maybe I'm to blame a little bit for this one time, at least this event, because I spoke the last time after the watermen came and approached and asked, you know, what about the Rappahannock, considering the dire straits they were going through in the James River, what about opening it up? And I made the comment that since this was my first term as commissioner, I would like, I think the term I used, to cut at the best science I possibly could have available, yes, as I engaged in this on behalf of not just the watermen, but the science as well. That was my intent, and it remains my intent to obtain the best science possible. Now, you've made a couple of several comments about this is no way to go about managing. And I think I understand where you're coming from, but that's the reason that the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel, which you've played a very integral part of, is up and running. We hope that this program, which has been reinstituted by Secretary Bryant, myself, the assistance of Jack and Jeff Corbin, and the rest, will be a somewhat of a think tank, compressed type situation where we can come out with a strategy that best utilizes the funds that are available, that best utilizes the science that's at our avail, and ultimately will best utilize, hopefully, the EIS, which will come out to tell us what direction we should be going in. So as I sit here as commissioner, that's where I was coming from when we started down this path last month. But again, I reiterate my thanks for the hard work. And there's no doubt a lot of thought, a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of different people weighed in providing this work product, and a very good work product you provided to us. And for that, I'm very grateful.
Thank you, sir. And like you, I have high hopes that the Blue Ribbon Panel will get us a little bit of ahead of working all of these things in short term. We really need to be thinking ahead so that we can actually do some planning and provide some stability to this industry. And I think that is going to be a very important tool in getting it.
And that is a mutual goal that we all share. It's not it, that's goes beyond whether we should open up the wrap for 30 days. I mean, this is the big picture.
Yeah.
And I take it very seriously.
Thank
Would you entertain some questions
Absolutely.
From?
Absolutely.
Mr. Tankard.
Dr. Mann, how many other places do you find or know of these unique type of oysters that you find in the Rappahannock right now in the state of Virginia?
As Dr. Wesson said, there are very small populations in some of these Potomac tributaries. The other place where we are beginning to see some truly unexpected observations are in Lynn Haven. Lynn Haven Bay, for those of you, I'm sure you're all familiar with this, is unusual in that many of the oysters there live in the intertidal. It's also a much saltier area. So in general, you would expect many of the disease pressure issues to be even more obvious there, because these diseases, their activity is modulated by high salinities. And yet in Lynn Haven, we are seeing a gradual resurgence of those populations in situations where, again, because of the salinities, you would expect these animals to all be dead. We don't have a harvest problem in the Lynn Haven. But I think where you're looking at these situations where after long periods of time of things literally just being left alone, things have been left alone in the lower Rappahannock since the middle 1980s because there was no fishing. It was closed by regulation in 1993. And so essentially you're looking here at 20 years of leaving someplace alone. I'm not sure what the comparable time frame is for the Lynn Haven, but it's approximately the same. If you leave it and you're looking at multiple generations of a very intense selection for animals that survive, you will see that in some of these places as well. By contrast, in areas that we harvest continually, the James being a good example, you see that these animals tend to be much more susceptible. Why? Because when they get really big, you go and harvest them. I mean, this is a difficult situation because you're trying to compromise and serve both sets of partners. You would like some old animals to survive, and you'd clearly like to support the industry at the same point in time. But there are other places, not too many of them, but they are nonetheless beginning to emerge at this point.
Further questions for Dr. Mann? Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you,
Appreciate
sir.
It. We'll now open up the public hearing on this issue. Mr. Kellum, good afternoon, sir.
Mr. Kellum, thank you.
You.
To start off, I would like to go back and take a look at what I had proposed in the original commission meeting.
For the record,
it's
Tommy Kellum.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Tommy. I'm sorry.
And look at what you heard, that in the Blue Ribbon panel meeting, we came up with a different proposal, which kind of answers Commissioner Bowden's comment on probably asking for more than was palatable in the original meeting. If we could go back to the...
That one goes up.
Okay, thank you. What was originally proposed, you know, was the entire south side of the Rappahannock. It did not include the oyster harvest areas there in the mouth. We know them as the spikes, as the rock name of the area. That did not include that. After the Blue Ribbon panel and going in and looking at the market stock of oysters that was in the BMRC data that you had last meeting, I went back and looked at the area that had the least amount of oysters according to those surveys and came up with an area that would come in just this side of Broad Creek, which, if you do the math on the scale of the rocks, it works out to about 25% of the harvestable area in that lower part of the river, including that spikes area. I've backed up to 25% of that. That 25% being the least population per the market analysis of oysters. I did that for two reasons. One, when I hear what Commissioner Tankard says about the future, no one buys that any more than I do. I've got a three-year-old son, and nothing would be any happier for me than for him to sit at the desk that I sit at that was my grandfather's, as him being a fifth-generation oyster processor. So I probably have as much to gain or lose out of this as anyone in this room, economically and personally. And when I look at this area, I think we're compromising from from the industry side and backing up to the least productive area in this entire area to harvest. One thing that really upsets me, I hear the word sound science, and I was privy, and I appreciate all the work that VIMS did in putting together their analysis and their recommendations on this area. And when I go through that, if the commission will allow me to do so, did everyone on the commission get a copy of VIMS's report? There are some things in there that I would just like to draw attention to. Number one, we talked, my first commission meeting I ever attended was in 1996, and it was a request by the watermen to open this very same area for harvest from the river down. We heard the broodstock issue. We heard all of the same things that we've heard today. I think it would be tough to attribute this population of oysters to the Oyster Heritage Program. I'm a member of the Oyster Heritage team. I'm still committed to it. I think we did the best things we could do. I stood in front of the Virginia Watermen's Association and explained why I recommended keeping this area closed at that time to give this thing a chance to take off. What we were looking at back in the late 90s, early 2000 was we've got this big plan coming up. We're going to try this. We're going to kick this off in a river it hadn't been done before. We're going to throw massive dollars at this, and that's why we need to keep this closed and not harvest this pocket of oysters. In that period of time, now we're backed up close to 10 years, and now we're saying, well, we've made this investment. We can't harvest these oysters, and it's the same reasons we heard in 1996. You heard in the last commission meeting that the Corps was going to come out, Corps of Engineers was going to come out with a group of local watermen and go look at these oysters in this area. I applaud them for doing so. I'm going to be critical in that meeting was set up around Mr. Travelstead being there and this sort of thing. When we got to the time, he was not there. So there was no one from VMRC, no one from VIMS, no one from any other agency that was involved in that. And we come away in the Blue Ribbon panel, which was 2 weeks after that field trip, and hear Colonel Aninos say, it's got to be something we can figure out to open a portion of this and see if these dirty oysters and these oysters die and if harvesting helps any. They found half of the oysters dead. They found the dirty, everything that we've been hearing from the watermen for years, we saw those things. Now, does that mean go in and take all the oysters? Now, of course not, but I think it at least is an argument to go in and take this little 25% block and at least monitor a harvest and see if harvest does have an effect. You hear the bagless dredging that Maryland still does that, and I would like to have some of their program looked at. Not only do they do bagless dredging, they switched their form of harvest last year from hand tonging to power dredging, which anyone with any history of the oyster business would know that 25 years ago, if you asked anyone in Maryland would they ever harvest oysters by power other than sail dredge, they would tell you absolutely not. But they've switched their form of harvest to dredging, and this is one of the reasons for doing that. They still bagless dredge. I can't speak to a study that was done, but I know in this past season they did their DNR did a massive bagless dredge in the area that had not been harvested, so I think there is some merit in that. But going from there, to be brief, this 25% area, when you look at it, I guess the question is that you got to look at is what damage, if this is the wrong thing to do, what damage do we do going in and harvesting this 25%? And I think you have to look at the standing stock to answer that. My comment in the last commission meeting was that I thought in November we would have 16 working days. We had 15 if the next 2 days of the month or the weather is feasible for harvest, and I think it will be. So I think if you look at December, we can ask that question again and say, well, we're probably looking at 16 or so working days. You take Christmas out. How much damage can be done in 16 days to an area that's been closed for 19 years, and we're using the same arguments 19 years later to keep it closed that we did in those original years. When you look at the standing stock numbers, it was the BIMS report that you guys got says that in the upper part, the harvested area, there was a standing stock, a 96 standing stock of 3,000 bushels of oysters. 3,000 bushels. When I came across the bridge, there were 16 boats working in this area today. Eight of them put their oysters out at my facility. I've bought almost 4,000 bushels to date, the VMRC records. And, like I say, I have probably 50% of the fleet. So if you say that other 50% is only 25% as good as what was caught, you're up to looking in the 6,000-7,000 bushels that were caught. Obviously, we didn't catch them all. There are reasons to argue the amount of oysters that we're being shown in this closed area. If you look at these numbers, I think we could argue the standing stock numbers. In conclusion, one thing that I read in this report that upset me, and I appreciate Dr. Mann's work. I appreciate everything VIMS does. They were originally put in place to be an arm for industry and the scientific community. That's what VIMS was started as, and I appreciate their role. But I'm seeing something here that many have heard me complain of before, and that's that there is no reason for anyone that says no to this, or no reason for anyone that says let's spend $10 million. They have to speak to no one on the results of these actions, whether it be to spend $44 million, I think is the number that's in here that's been spent. No one has to, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. That's all we say is, well, maybe it would have took $88 million. And I read in here that to the best of the knowledge, no one at VIMS was ever consulted about the choice of the site for the Rappahannock River on the Oyster Heritage Project. I went to every Oyster Heritage meeting. I'm sure there are public records on those. There were at least 4 to 5 VIMS members there. And I never, if anyone here was in any of those meetings and heard anything different, I never heard anyone express any of the concerns that we just heard about management, about how much we're spending, where we're doing it, what we're doing it for. It was, this is a thing to do. We need to push forward with this. And that's what we heard. And actually, the Oyster Heritage meeting panel has met after the Gilmore administration. So I would argue with the fact that it was because the governor had his thumb on anyone. Actually, and I think Dr. Wesson would agree, the Oyster Heritage was a very wide open forum. Anyone was allowed to say anything they wanted. They were allowed to comment. And I just hate to see all of a sudden now that that's not such a good idea. Everyone wants to jump ship and say, I didn't have anything to do with that. I told them it was a bad idea. And if this is how we're going to manage fisheries, I think my future in this industry is pretty limited as far as depending on Virginia's portion of the Chesapeake Bay to fund my industry with any resource. And again, I don't want that taken as I don't appreciate all the disease work and all the work that VIMS has done. I did. But I just hate, when I go home tonight and I don't have resource for my industry, for my business, I've got 125 people to answer to. I just would like, at some point in time, someone answer to these proposals, and I'll answer. I was 100% in favor of the Oyster Heritage. I think we are seeing some benefits of it. The shell, the infrastructure is there. We produce habitat for other species. Do I think it was worth $9 million? Probably not. Can I say that this population of oysters that I'm wanting to harvest is a result of this? No, absolutely not. It's the same population that we wanted to harvest, well, that I was not in favor of harvesting prior to this, the Oyster Heritage Program. We've had 6 years for it to take hold. That's 6 bat sets, and we still can't show any better results than we did before we started. I appreciate the opportunity, and again, I agree that this 25% is the right thing to do. Mr. Bowden, going back to your initial comment, it was probably a little more
aggressive.
And I'd be less than honest, and I don't know if the scientific community speaks this way, but I'll speak up and say that my asking for that was thinking we'd probably end up here.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you.
Question for Mr. Kelly.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Kellum, can you put your hand up there and show me what you're proposing, the new proposal would be?
What my proposal is, and one of the conflicting things here is that when you look at this, we're probably going by the amount of water that's open. When you think, how much are you going to harvest, we're looking at an area. Actually, what we're looking at is harvestable reefs, and if you went back to the original proposal, that the scale drawings I gave of the harvest rocks in the Rappahannock, basically what will be allowed to harvest is the area off of Parrott's Island, known as Parrott's Rock, and the North End Rock. There is a
Can you point to those?
Can you, yeah.
This is the North End Rock,
mm-hmm.
and then Parrott's Island is where you see Parrott's Island off of the face of that coming around.
Mm-hmm.
These were areas that all of my life have always been productive. Not just these areas, but all of these rocks were productive oyster rocks, and that's why they were targeted, rightfully so, by the Oyster Heritage Program to be areas to focus on having enhanced harvest areas for sanctuary reefs. And going back to that, I've been quoted in the media as wanting to harvest sanctuaries. My proposal, if you remember, was to leave out the harvest, the broodstock sanctuaries that we relocated broodstock on as sanctuaries and not to harvest them. And I've looked at going a step further with that and looking at some legislation that would, by code, these areas are not protected. They're only protected by regulation by this commission. And I have a problem with the fact that in 10 years, if we had an industry aggressive commission that an oyster broodstock sanctuary reef that was built by someone such as CBF, it's no reason why that should ever be harvested. They spent their time, their money, their effort stocking that broodstock reef. That ought to be protected by law forever as a sanctuary. So with that being said, I just would like for you to keep in mind that my proposal is to still keep the sanctuary area reefs in this area closed for harvest. And that, with any amount that we open up, I would say would encompass.
So you wouldn't have any trouble dropping from the area there, drawing a line down the middle of the channel up to the bridge either, and just saying go south of that?
No, it's one rock on the north side called Lawson's Bay Rock. I would guess the watermen here would probably argue that it's probably only a handful of watermen in that area of the bay that can go to that rock and even find it anymore, because it's been so long since these rocks were worked. But I would have no problem in my proposal amending it to shoot a line from the middle of the bridge to that furthest offshore point. I think we have to pick areas that are enforceable as far as the designations that we pick to open. In addition to that, I would ask the commission that if this was passed, that we conveyed through the ranks the importance of enforcement, and that we get the type of enforcement we got in the James River last year, which I think was excellent. We had an area open that hadn't been opened for harvest to the magnitude it was, and VMRC put the people there to take care of it.
Some didn't think it was so great.
No, and I don't think that it's been good on the upper part of the Rappahannock. I think we've been too lax on what we're harvesting now. But that's a separate issue. I just would like for, if we do decide to open any of this area, that the enforcement of the laws be put in place.
Points well made. Mr. Tankard.
A question for Mr. Kellum. I appreciate the situation you find yourself in, but I have a question for you with your knowledge of the oyster, in particular this area. I mean, do you agree with Mr. Mann that this oyster that you find there now is a unique oyster, and that it has come up in a disease environment, and that it has some genetic value?
I do, and that's my reason for not asking for it all to be open. I think that's always been there. If you go back through history in the 70s, and I tell you, I've spent more time in the last month going through the archives we have in history, back to where we harvested, what rocks it came from, this sort of thing. When you look at the Rappahannock, it seemed to always be one of the first areas to rebound with harvest behind a death. And that's one of the reasons that in 96 it was asked to be open, was because it's always been a pocket of unique oysters. I don't agree that the Lynn Haven is in the class with the Rappahannocks. And if you look at the death loss in the Rappahannocks or in the Lynn Haven, I think it's overstated at how much disease resistance they have. If what the Corps saw, and I know Doug Jenkins from the Twin River Watermen's Association will speak because he was on the boat, but if the amount of oysters was still in this area that were 3 to 4 years old that were dead, were still there alive, it would be an enormous population there. So they are still dying. But yes, I would agree that there is reason to protect 75% of this population. And you, when you look in your report from VIMS, Dr. Stan Allen said that it would take approximately 1,000 oysters to create a brood stock that were in a like area. So I think when you look at that, when you take into play the brood stock question, we're leaving massive amounts above 1,000 oysters in the same locations. And that speaks to why to open one specific area, not to go in and open areas here, there, and everywhere. I saw in Vim's report a checkerboard type opening. I don't agree with that, because then you're just taking density in one specific area away. And if it's merit to the broodstock, why would you want to take broodstock away from this area and broodstock away from here and take a chance of not having enough population in that on that oyster rock?
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Kellum.
Thank you.
What's next? Mr. Jenkins? Good afternoon, sir.
Afternoon, Commissioner Bowen, members of the board.
I'll hand them for you, Doug. Thank you.
I'd like to have this graph up there that Dr. Lester put on the harvest area and the unharvest area. And this thing is Dutch to me. My grandson and granddaughter can work on it. I can't. I'm one of them old boys. Doug Jenkins, representing the Twin River Watermen Association. Also, Jeff Crockett. When he left here, he told me he had to catch a boat. But we talked at length out in the hall. And Jeff said to speak on his behalf, too. He discussed my remarks that I'm going to make here today. Sorry. Jack, Jim, I want y'all to do this too. Dr. Weston had spoke early on bagless dredging. Didn't know what result of that would be. Well, I want to inform y'all, bagless dredging and dredging the rock daily and bringing the oysters and the shells to the top, culling through them and throwing them back overboard and letting them go down to the bottom, there's a whole lot of difference. That's the difference between that and night and day. He said that from his information that Maryland didn't have any data on that showed that that was improvement. Several years ago, I bought a pamphlet from the Maryland Department of Natural Resources showing, and gave it to Commissioner Pruitt, that they had some sunken rocks in the upper part of the bay that hadn't been worked for years because it was closed, and they let the watermen go back in there and work them, and they'd been working them 3 or 4 years, and the rocks had come alive, and they was having spat set on them, and they was doing fine. That's contradicted what he said. He also said that Potomac River Commission never had a sanctuary in it, and that is also wrong. They had sanctuaries after Agnes, 72. They bought horses out of the lower part of the river, put them up Swan Point, and kept them closed 5 years. And then we went back there and harvested them. So I just want to clarify that. And another thing here, Dr. Weston doesn't even believe his own charts. You can see where they've harvested and where they haven't harvested, and you see the spike there and the spat going up. That's a result of maybe Captain Bob's concrete reefs he's got down there underneath the water, and the waterman working on those bars, cleaning the shells up so the horses will strike on it. Now I'll get to my prepared remarks. Virginia is one of the leading states in apple production. Virginia is also one of the leading states in poultry production. If a disease, parasite, virus, or something that affected the production of either one of these industries, the General Assembly, Virginia Tech, and the federal government would come to their rescue in a heartbeat, because it's a good food source and it adds jobs to the economy. One would think that the oyster industry deserves as much attention and funding as growing apples and chickens. It's a valuable food source and it adds jobs to the economy. But you can raise chickens and apples in all of the 50 states. But there's only one Chesapeake Bay. It was once the leading area in all of the United States of oyster production. Disease, weather patterns, and mismanagement has crippled its production in the last 20 years. What happened to the scientific brains and the $45 million spent to fix the oyster industry once it began to have problems? I serve on the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel now. Dr. Roger Mann, which you just heard earlier from VIMS, who has been working with Dr. Jim Weston, told us several meetings ago that that program has been a failure. 15 years of study, research, building reefs, and spending $45 million, they are no better off now than they were when this started. Several years ago, when Governor Warner was in the office, DDOT opened up a section of Interstate 64 and found out the engineers had messed up, which cost the state a lot of money and delayed the project. He fired them. Proper thing to do. It happens all the time in the real life in private sector. If you don't produce, you're gone. I would like for you to look at your maps that I just passed out to you earlier of the lower Potomac River. I highlighted the rivers there on the Maryland side, and I highlighted the ones on the Virginia side. The Maryland side, there's a tributary there called St. Mary's River. Maryland watermen have been harvesting their limit of 24 bushel oysters per day now since it opened the 1st of November. They catch their limit by 10:30, 11 o'clock. This is not something I'm making up, gentlemen. I'm telling you the facts, and that's what I'm sticking with. Opposite side of the river, you have the Yocomica and Cone River, Virginia tributaries. They're closed. And the Virginia Mormon aren't harvesting anything. I guess we are supposed to clean up the bay with ours. One thing I have observed by serving on the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel, there are too many chiefs and not enough graves. The replenishment officer in the past worked and cooperated with the watermen in all areas of the state. Moved seed to growing areas, open areas that needed to be open, and watermen had places they could work all winter. He didn't spend his time trying to teach people how to grow horses and floats on in the fields or pile up mounds of shells that are washing away and covering up good billet oyster balls. Mr. Sadler and Mr. Daniels, the replenishment officers of years past spent that time replenishing the oyster balls, not closing them or covering them up with shells. The Virginia Watermen Association and the Twin River Watermen Association hired a dredge boat to test the oyster rocks below Route 3 Bridge, as well as those above the bridge, to see the difference in the two areas. We invited Jack Travis to it, and Assistant Secretary Jeff Coleman from Natural Resources, Corps of Army Engineers, and others, to view both areas so they would have first-hand observation of the oyster rocks. Jack said he couldn't attend. He had an appointment in Richmond. Jeff couldn't make it. However, the colonel from the Corps of Engineers and Mark Manfield went along on the boat. And we would like to have, I wish that each one of you board members could have been aboard. Trying to regulate, trying to schedule a day to meet everybody's needs was difficult. Unfortunately, the boat went ahead all of y'all anyway. If you had been on the boat and observed what we observed, it wouldn't have been in your question in your mind today how to make your vote. It's a shame to have a resource as important as the oyster being destroyed by silt, toad blisters, and decaying seagrass, which is smothering the tops of them back. It's also a shame for those who are responsible not to listen to common sense. So I'm asking you today to open up the area below the Rappahannock Bridge, as well as the Yocomica and the Cone Rivers. I'm asking that not for the watermen's sake, but for the health and the welfare of the oyster rocks. They need to be worked, and it won't cost the taxpayers one dime. Scientific grains and stakeholders in the oyster herds want to study and do research, they can do it elsewhere. There's a big bay out there, but leave our baleful survey ground alone so we'll have oysters in the future, and we'll have oyster rocks that are healthy and surviving in the future. I've been around a long time in the oyster industry. I've oystered the different rivers up and down the bay, and I've seen the oysters die out, and there wasn't neither a dime spent on their recovery. And you're talking about brood stock, there was always enough left there to come back and have a heavy set when the weather and the water quality got to produce that. And it will happen again. It's happened four or five times in my lifetime. I'm 71 years old, and I started working on the water when I was 13. We had to leave the Potomac River to go over on the Rappahannock to make a living for two or three years. We had oysters over there that could harvest. There wasn't enough to harvest over on Potomac. And a few years later, it would be so many over on Potomac that boats come from Smith Island, Tangier, and all over the bay that had to harvest them. And they died out and they came back again. I'm a little older and I've seen a little more than Roger Brown or Dr. Jim Weston and some of these others. If you want to take that for advice, it's good, sound, honest advice. And I'll put my hand on the Bible or I'll go through a lie detector, anything that I've said here today. I just hope some of these others would. Thank you. You got any questions?
No, thank you, Doug. Thank you very much for your presentation. Who's next? Jenkins?
Yes, sir.
The other Mr. Jenkins.
Oh, okay. I have a back to you, sir. You don't get to go twice.
Okay.
Well, how are you, sir?
Members of the board.
State your name for the record, please.
My name is Lionel Jenkins.
And who you represented?
I'm representing the warblers in my area.
Okay.
My boy took his boat to Potomac Thursday, and he worked yesterday. He caught 39 bushels of oyster. Another boy right beside him, both of them left James River the same day. He had 44 bushels of oyster. He trucked them home and sold them to a shucker that lives right next door to me. There's a lot of things that go on that everybody don't hear about. I'm sure that Jim couldn't have heard about that because it only happened yesterday, you know. But there's been oysters being caught in Potomac right along the whole year. However, the Potomac is not the issue here today. It's the Rappahannock. Now, you know, I farmed for 25 years. I crop farm and I raise some cattle and hogs. But if I bought a bunch of cattle in and put them on pasture and they begin to die, I got a vet over there and he checked them out and he said, you got some disease, anthrax or hoof and mouth disease or something like that. All these animals are going to have to be destroyed. If I say to him, no, I'm going to collect the ones that I don't think is sick and destroy the ones that's showing a sign of being sick, then I go and get me some more cattle and bring and put in that herd, I'm asking for trouble. I'm going to affect every cow that I bring in that herd because I did not take away the effective ones before I started over again. It's the same way I believe into all the rivers. You're talking about saving the old oysters. Well, how long does an oyster live? Gentlemen, look around you. We're not as strong now as we were when we were 25 years old. All my hair's gone. I got glasses. Fortunately, I still got all my teeth. But anyway, old is not always the best. In fact, I think young is the best. But anyway, as far as oysters, when it comes down to reproduction, Doug Jenkins said it. I worked in the Potomac River 37 years ago, the first time I went there. There were so many oysters there, we couldn't sell them. All of the mussels had died off of them, and there was nothing but big oysters. No spats, just big oysters. We could only sell 3 days a week, and we were on a limit then. It wasn't anything to go outside, just outside the creek to the first beacon, and catch 60, 70 bushels. Just one tonga. It took two people to cull for one. Within 2 or 3 years later, it was all different ballgame. You couldn't hardly make a living there. That happened 2 or 3 times during my life cycle that I oyster. Now, as far as opening the Rappahannock, what I see is this. There is no winner here. If you open this section in the Rappahannock and it turns out to be no oysters there, the people are going to have to quit and go home. They are not going to hurt it. On the other hand, if there's no oysters there, what this panel has done in the past 19 years is wasted $45 million, and it's a total failure. Because certainly in 19 years, if these oysters hasn't produced enough that they can stand working on for 30 days, you certainly don't have much to build on. Whether you got one reef or 1,000 reefs, if it can't stand working for 30 days to prove once and for all that whether the scientists are right, whether the liaison officer is right, or whether the waterman's right is irrelevant here. This is your one chance to prove what you have or what you don't have. Now, one month's work is not going to break and not going to make a waterman rich, and it's not going to cause him to go in the poorhouse. I say that it's only in the best interest of this panel to find out for sure, to put to rest, whether the scientists are right or whether the stupid waterman is right. However you want to take it. But anyway, I don't believe that it can be hurt within 30 days. If you open the whole river and you had every boat that ever was there scraping on it, you can't hurt it. Because if there's nothing there, you can't hurt it. And if it is anything there, it proves that we haven't been getting the right data. So that's my argument here today. I would recommend that you open what Mr. Kellum has proposed. And it's up to you people to do what you want. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Jenkins. Who's next? Yes, sir. Good afternoon, sir.
How you doing?
Fine, thank you.
My name is Julian Cox.
Sir, Cox, good to have you here.
From Pocosin, and I'm an orchard gardener.
Yes, sir.
And I'd like to say a few words in opposition to opening these reefs. And I sent you all a letter that was about 7 pages long. And the content of that letter was based on the 1988 report to the oyster industry by Drs. Fargus and Hagen, Virginia Institute of Marine Science. And in that report, one of the messages I got was, it took Mother Nature thousands of years to build these reefs. And at the outset, say 150 years ago, when we really started harvesting them and got better and better and better at it, taking these oysters off these reefs, according to their 1988 document, there were just thousands and thousands of acres of these reefs, of the oyster rocks. And the basic content of their report talked about how these reefs were essentially destroyed over a long period of time. And I was comparing that and thinking about that while people were talking about 10-year periods. That's a very small segment of time, at least in my experience in oyster gardening, doing restoration work and raising oysters. So I have a bit of hands-on experience as well as the reading the technical documents experience. I think it's important to recognize that if we spent $10 million restoring some reefs, I think what you're looking at, there's a lot of irreversibilities of the damage that was done up until this point. What's on the table today is essentially the remnants of what was there back when Baylor did his survey many years ago. So I guess that one of the things I wanted to do was communicate to the commission that it's clear to me that we need to protect and restore what we can. And there's no instant pudding. And it's not going to be cheap. Again, trying to do in a 10-year period what Mother Nature did in thousands of years is going to cost a whole lot more. So I'm not shocked at all by the fact that it cost $10 million just to do a few reefs. Now, I think values are changing too in our society. It's clear to me that the water cleansing capability of the oysters growing on protected and restored natural oyster reefs, combined with a growing community of oyster gardeners and a growing farm-based oyster industry. In other words, the farmers harvest what they sow. And to me, these are the best management practices to mitigate and offset the increased pollution caused by our ever-increasing activities living in the Bay watershed. So the oysters growing on the public reefs, since they're all public reefs, I feel like they're my oysters too. And I request that the I think most of the remaining oysters on these reefs should be cultivated and made better, because I think most citizens in Virginia, in the Virginia economy, would be best helped by using these oysters to keep our water clean. So I support the VMRC staff recommendations as presented, and I thank you for listening to my comments.
Thank you.
I'd be glad to answer any questions. Debbie.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Who's next? Tommy? Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. I'm Tommy Leggett with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, and there are portions of everything that I've heard from members in the audience that I agree with. This is a difficult situation. But CBF supports the staff recommendation and the findings of VIMS. Our basis for support lies in the value of the disease-tolerant oysters in the lower Rappahannock to restoration of the resource in general and the future commercial harvest in upstream portions of the river. With respect to the Rappahannock River, CBF supports the idea of having the Oyster Heritage Foundation partners design a system of harvest and sanctuaries for the entire river and present the plan to the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel for consideration. We don't want to see the river closed forever. It's in everybody's best interest to have a healthy resource, not only for the industry, but for the ecology of the bay. The commission reconvened the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel this year to evaluate oyster restoration and management strategies. To make substantial changes in oyster management at this time is inconsistent with the intended purpose of the commission's director for the panel. It is anticipated that the panel complete its task prior to next season, next oyster season, with recommendations for the long-term management of the oyster resource for the industry and the bay. CBF is also supportive of the idea of exploring the possibility of using hatchery-produced oyster seed on public rocks for revitalizing the industry. I suspect that what Lionel Jenkins was referring to was a seed plant that Jim referred to as spat on shell that was planted in the Potomac below Cedar Bar a number of years ago, and it's now market size. And it's great that watermen are out there harvesting it. That's something that's very viable. It's something that's done in Maryland, and it's the basis for a bulk of the Maryland oyster fishery. Currently, Virginia and Maryland oystermen are harvesting that area, and I haven't seen exactly the harvest, but I believe what Lionel is saying, 39 to 40 bushels. And it's also possible that similar efforts in Virginia may be even more successful simply as a result of geography, since oysters typically grow faster in higher salinity regions of the lower bay. So I would suspect that we would have higher success in our portion of the bay. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, Tommy. What's next? Gentlemen, did you have your hand up? Yes, sir.
I don't know if you're supposed to send a letter in order to talk.
No, sir, absolutely not.
My name is John Parton. 60 years ago, I lived at 59 Fenwick Way on Fort Monroe next to the lighthouse. And I took great pleasure watching the byboats come in by the score. I was quite surprised to return 10 years ago and find that the oyster population in the bay has essentially been driven to near extinction. And reflecting on what might be done about this, I think public policy ought to be driven as much as possible by scientific evidence. And I also think the commission should take into consideration the time scales that might be involved. It has taken about 150 or 125 years to reduce the population of the Chesapeake Bay oyster to the point where it seems unlikely to be able to sustain itself. And it seems reasonable that it will take quite a long time for protected areas to raise the population and bring us back from the brink. As a matter of fact, it might be possible to construct some models which would predict how long a sanctuary area ought to be left undisturbed before it could have a positive effect. And if this be the case, it seems like we ought not to go every year and attack the areas that have been set aside with the hope of restoring our oyster population.
Thank you, sir. What's next? Paula? Ms. Jasinski? Good afternoon, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Paula Jasinski with NOAA Chesapeake Bay Office, and I want to thank you for allowing us to make some comments about this issue today. I also want to thank Mr. Kellum for coming up with a very thoughtful proposal. I think he honestly tried to come up with a very fair proposal, and I appreciate all the thought he put into that. However, I am here today to support the VIMS and the VMRC position to maintain these areas as being closed for a couple of reasons. NOAA has invested a lot of money and time in these areas, but we've also invested a lot of money and time in the upstream areas, in the northern areas that have been open for harvest. So I don't want the state or the panelists to think that every dollar we put here, we want protected in perpetuity. That's not the goal. And we are working currently with the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel to make sure that we help the state and participate in the long-term management of this resource in the future. So we are very interested in that process, and also I want to echo Tommy Leggett's recent comments that I do hope that this panel can complete its work before next season and come up with some recommendations that help both restoration and the repletion program, including sanctuaries and developing some definitions for those in the state, because currently there are none, and I think that leads to a lot of confusion among all the partners. I also hope that this plan comes up with very tributary by tributary specific areas and develops harvest and sanctuary areas in both that are enforceable areas. And I think we've had some issues in the past with having these areas adjacent to each other, and we've run into problems, but hopefully those can be addressed in the future. And one other comment I had is that the Bay Program pulled together a group in the year 2000 to come up with some recommendations, and that panel included watermen, environmentalists, other state agencies, a lot of federal agencies, to come together and develop a long-term plan for oyster resources across the Bay. And one of the issues they addressed in there was sanctuaries. The proposal that was in that report was that at least 10% of the state's resources should be set aside as sanctuaries. And I believe currently Virginia is about 1% or less. And so I would just urge the panel to consider that when you look at whether or not to open certain areas, is that there's currently very little set aside area in the state.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions, Ms. Jasinski? Thank you, Paula. Anyone else? Mr. Erskine?
Good afternoon.
How are you?
A.J. Erskine, representing Bevan's Oyster Company and Coward Seafood. I believe you have a letter regarding some of the the issues to open up the Potomac River tributaries. And I won't reiterate that, but I just wanted to make one comment in addition to those concerns that we had. We also maintain a few experiments with the Bay Foundation, with VIMS, that are also some spat-on shell experiments that are not completed. Those pieces of oyster ground are right next to public grounds, so we would be concerned about potential harvesting of those areas if there were issues with the law enforcement issues of crossing private and public grounds. But those projects will come to a completion at the middle of next year, potentially. I just wanted to reiterate what Jim Wesson mentioned about the available oysters, market-sized oysters that were assessed as being in the Yukamako and the Cone Rivers. We're talking about a few hundred, maybe several hundred bushels versus the Rappahannock, several thousand. I think it's important to keep in mind that if there were a few spat sets that were observed in those tributaries, most likely it was a result of those oysters. And if we're encouraging spat sets and recovery and future recruitment in those tributaries, I think it's important to maintain some level of broodstock in the Potomac and the Virginia tributaries of the Potomac. This area was open to dredging in 2005 and presumably took some of those market-sized oysters out of the system. So what we have remaining now is potentially a level that we'd be able to see future spat sets and recruitment to those rivers. Thank you.
Any questions from Mr. Erskine? Thank you, sir. Anyone else? Sir, Kevin? Then, gentlemen in the back, be next.
Good afternoon, Commissioner. How
are you, sir?
I'm Kevin Wade from Deltaville, Virginia. I certainly didn't send a letter, nor did I plan to speak today. But I just wanted to say I appreciate everyone's comments and the science, and I've been in the CP business for 25 years. And even in my company, I know that a big part of that success is teamwork and compromise. And I think what Mr. Kellum has presented is a good compromise, and we can certainly benefit from the dispute of whether they're harvesting or they're non-harvesting. If we are in that little 25% area, we will have the data to show what effect did it have. That's it.
Thank you, sir. Gentlemen in the back.
My name is William Nelson. I've been working on the water for 25 years, been dredging, shaft tonguing, and all the rivers. There seems to be a lot of talking in circles amongst the scientists here. If you pass that around, I appreciate it. Science is a wonderful thing, but it's not always correct. It's based on theory. Some of it's on fact. It takes a lot of time to find the facts. We started dredging. I'm not real sure about that. Maybe Mr. Wesson better about the date of it, but we started up there in the Rappahannock, I would say in 96, and that first year that we went there, there was nothing. There was no strike, very few oysters. We had a 4-bushel limit at that time, and you could get your 4 bushels. Now we have a 10-bushel limit, and you can still get your 10 bushels. There's strike on everything, the oysters, the shell, everything. Mr. Jensen has a couple of reefs. He has Steamer Rock and Christchurch Rock. And if you look at this chart right here, one of these rocks, Steamer Rock is over here. Christchurch Rock is here, and Steamer Rock is up here somewhere. His reefs are made of concrete and came from the Norris Bridge. And I feel that those two reefs in themselves and the watermen turning those rocks over and working them, keeping the legal size oysters and putting back the smaller stuff, spreading it out on the bottom so it can grow, is what's making those oysters there. And you saw his graph earlier. He's got the graph up there. It shows harvested and not harvested area. How come there's just as much strike, spat, and small oysters in the harvested area as what's on the side that's not harvested? Last year, Mr. Pruitt sent me out there with Mr. Jensen. One of the scientists was Vims was supposed to come. We went to that side. We went over to Parrot's Rock. We went across to Christchurch Sanctuary Rock that he had there. Everywhere we saw oysters. We saw oysters, big oysters. No small oysters, no strike, nothing but big oysters. And dog stones or tunicates, whatever you want to call them, sea squirts, which is, I'm not a scientist, but I have got access to the internet just like the scientists do. And this sea squirt, which is populated on top of the oysters, is a single cell creature as close to you and me as anything. Been around as long as we have. It takes water in and pushes water out. And it filters the food particles out of that. Now, to me, if they're laying on top of these broodstock oysters, which that paper right there tells you, there is no such thing as a broodstock. And the man who wrote that paper is sitting right in here. The young oysters are the ones that are spawning. That's the ones that the watermen are throwing back on the bottom with the shells to let them grow. They're the ones that's doing the spawning, not the broodstock oysters. The broodstock oysters are the ones that are laying there on the bottom dying. Because when you got those tunicates sitting on top of them, if there is any larvae that comes out of them, they eat it as soon as it comes out of them. Now, when you got Steamer Rock and you got the Christchurch Rock, of Mr. Jensen's concrete. Nobody can dredge that. Nobody can tong that. That's there. Whatever oysters strike on that, when the larvae comes off of them, they spin around and they go back there and land on those rocks that we're working. Now, Mr. Weston would have you believe that his brood stock on this side of the river is going to go up there and strike where we've been working. That's completely wrong, because any scientist and anybody that goes out there and works on the river knows that the river flushes itself once a month, and the tide goes 2 more hours out than it comes in. So how is any larvae from the upper side going to get to the lower side? It's not going out in the bay. You know, I've been here since 93, done speeches, wrote speeches, carried on, jumped up and down, and it's always the same thing. You know, I feel like a pirate. I dress like a pirate. I feel like I've been treated like a pirate. I'm out there trying to make an honest day's living. And, of course, there's others that don't. They may want to go out there and take some small ones or whatever. If you go out there and do it right and open everything up and let that bottom get worked, these sanctuaries, everybody's talking about a sanctuary. We got a sanctuary here. We got a sanctuary there. Good. They're reefs that we can't even touch. It's just a little reef with two poles in between it. A three-dimensional shell reef will change zip codes in a hurricane. It's not a three-dimensional shell reef anymore. When we went out there and tested those areas, anything on that reef, some stuff was on it, but there wasn't any more on the reef than anywhere else. And if those reefs stay out there, which they should, just like everybody else said, whatever brood stock you got on that, maybe eventually we'll go over the shells, but if the shells are covered up with muck and dog stones, what's it going to strike on? All that brood stock larvae for what? For not. Millions of dollars for nothing. We're just trying to preserve a work ethic, basically. That's what it is. And we're trying to put Virginia back on the economy as an oyster harvester. We've got two little areas that we work. Every boat from James River, the whole Tangier fleet, everybody has twisted around on them rocks just as hard as they can go. I had the opportunity to go down to Mississippi. I went down there. The Virginia oysters down in Mississippi, too, and in the Gulf. Virginia oysters went down there by train years and years ago before I was born. They got dredges down there that'll scare you, scare everybody, scared me when I went down there. I saw the size of those dredges and two of them on a boat going out there. Our dredge has got a 22-inch bar, a little light 50-pound dredge. It's 100-pound dredges down there. They're dragging them wide open on the bottom. I saw more strike, more small oysters, more oysters than I've ever seen in my life. But the same thing happened down there, and it's happening right here now. They took all the shells out and never put them back. I really believe that what few people there are to work now, if you opened all of that up and planted them shells back there every year in a timely fashion, you'd see more oysters, and it wouldn't cost anybody nothing, just some work. And that's all we want to do anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson.
Thank you.
Anyone else? All right, we'll close the public hearing on the matter. Matters before the commission for discussion. Mr. Bowden?
I think we can really look at this two ways. Did we say 5,800 bushels is what it has, basically what it says in the report? 3,000 above, 58 below. By sacrificing 40 or 50,000 bushels that could have been harvested over the time frame? I mean, if that's the case, that's in a very expensive reef. I hear two different numbers. I would like to get Mr. Weston to address them, $9 million and $44 million. Several people have mentioned $44
million. $9 million in the Rappahannock.
It's 99.
It's $9 million in the Rappahannock.
Okay, $44 in the whole state.
Yeah.
Okay. I know I sympathize with the gentleman who says it took 125 years to destroy the oysters. I can tell you one single event done more than anything. MFX, as you know, has been devastating on the whole East Coast. It's been studied for 40 or 50 years. I'm not aware we know any more now than we did, and if we did, there's nothing we can do about it evidently, because if it was, we would have done it, basically. So I don't see how Mr. Callum's request would damage any oyster resource. And on top of that, I think it may very well help. It's, you know, it's a gamble, but everything you do in life is a gamble. And I think this is a gamble worthwhile taking. I know several people would like to see the whole thing open. I wouldn't feel confident in doing that. I think, you know, we can open 25%, go back and look at it. One thing stuck in my mind when we had this up there about the oysters above and below the bridge. Yes, there was more large oysters below the bridge, but it was more small and spat set above the bridge. It wasn't just large oysters. So evidently, you know, the only way we're going to get large oysters is have spat set in small oysters. There's no other physical way you can do it that I'm aware of. So when it comes time, I'd like to make a motion. But I think we need more discussion before that.
Dr. McConaughey?
Yeah. Unfortunately, we really don't have the data to tell what happens to the those large oysters in the lower part are obviously spawning. They're producing a lot of larvae. We don't have the physical data to actually look at where those are going, but it's entirely possible that the larvae and the eggs and that are being produced in the lower part are your source of spat in the upper above the bridge. Having worked in larval ecology for a long time, the physics suggests that, in fact, there is a flow along the bottom on the north side of that river that's going to move things up there. So I'm not really comfortable, without having some more knowledge about where the spat is coming from. It could possibly be coming from out in the bay itself. But without having that kind of information, I'm a little hesitant to start taking those large oysters out there. They also, because they are more, appear to be more disease resistant, we may be able to learn more by studying those and understanding some of the disease processes than we can taking them out. I am sympathetic to the watermen, and I understand they need work, but I'm not convinced that we're in a position to do that on a short notice. If we went back to waiting for recommendations from the Blue Ribbon Panel and coming up with a management plan for next year, it might be a better plan, and we might ultimately decide to open that whole area. But right now, I don't feel all that comfortable making that move with what we know.
Mr. Fox?
I look at the tributaries of the Potomac differently than the Rappahannock oil. I think they're two different issues. And I think it's been said that there are 500 bushels, perhaps, a few more or less, in the tributaries of the Potomac. And also from what I've heard from people who work up there, Mr. Erskine and others, and also from Jim Wesson, that it would appear that because of the small cut-up parcels that are up there and because of some spat set that has come, working in those rivers is going to be clearly more detrimental than beneficial for the 500 you get. And so from my point of view, it makes no sense whatsoever to work in those rivers. In the Rappahannock, I guess I'm torn. I heard what Dr. Conaughey just says, and it would be good if we had the data of where the larvae flows from and to, and then maybe we could come up with an area that would that we could let people harvest in that would do the least damage to the potential spatfall in the river. And maybe Dr. Weston can help us with where that might be. And I think we do have something very valuable in these oysters that are potentially disease resistant, and I would suggest that the first thing we need to do is immediately go get I'd say 3,000 oysters, not 1,000, but 3,000 oysters for Dr. Stan Allen, and let him begin his work with that, and we should do that right away, because they might die in the next year. I also was impressed by Mr. Cox's statement. We had lots of people who spoke in favor of harvesting, but I think we also had a lot of people who were not here to speak. And when Mr. Cox said, "These are my oysters too," I thought that was a very telling statement. And so I think that this commission needs to think about the people who are not represented here, the residents of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and what their feelings are. So, you know, is some compromise available? Is there some way to split the baby in an intelligent way? I don't see that we've seen it yet, but I'm open to the possibility that maybe there is.
Mr. Schick?
Well, you know, we've heard a lot about how, you know, the science hasn't worked, but that's usually the way it works. You keep plugging in a problem until you solve it, and usually you make a lot of mistakes. The baby falls down, and then it starts to crawl, and it starts to walk. Well, we're still in the crib, you know. We're falling out of the crib. You know, opening up this could be just another one of the mistakes that we're making in this whole, you know, range of what we're doing. Will it produce some information? Yes. You know, we'll get something out of it. You know, not just the, you know, the oysters, which is important as far as for the industry, but the scientific community will get something out of the harvest from this area. They'll also get something out of it from if they don't harvest it. You know, they've been working the upper half too. You know, compromise is something I can work with. You know, I think, you know, we've probably been compromising this whole area since it opened up. I don't want to step on the toes of the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel. I think letting them do their job is very important. You know, their job is much more than just this little area that we're talking about. You know, their survival of an industry is in their hands. Their survival of the species locally is in their hands. And a long-range plan has to be made. So, you know, let's figure out what we're going to do then. Yeah.
Mr. Tankard?
Yes, sir. You know, Mr. Kellum's about my age, I suspect, and I've got young children, too, and I grew up on Bayford with Roscoe and Hooksy Walker, attending a lot of the fellows that came in from Tangier, and I've cut my feet on oysters and watched that population go into just a bunch of mud. Bought a boat from a fellow whose family's been in the oyster business for a couple hundred years because he couldn't make a living anymore. No more than I hate to see it happen, but I say to myself and think today that for our children to have a possibility of a real oyster population in the future, I hate to say it, but I feel better about seeing this sanctuary or this area not harvested, because the thing that I've learned in this massive volume of material that y'all have given me here is that there's actually a bright spot in the oyster population. That there are oysters out there that are living today. They're all gone. They're 3 and 4 years old. I think that itself is a great asset and something for the future of our industry and something that maybe my children will eat in the future. So I see a greater benefit for the future in leaving this area protected.
Mr. Robbins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think Dr. Mann said it best today when he said we need a management plan for this area, and that's not what we're doing right now. I think between the industry's request to open this area and between the ongoing discussion in the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel that's occurring right now, I think an opportunity has been created, and I think that opportunity is specifically to look at redesigning the sanctuary and developing a comprehensive and long-term management plan for the Rappahannock system. And I think that's where we need to move as a commission. I think we need to enable and encourage that. And I think that the opening as proposed doesn't put us any closer towards a management plan. I think if we go through the process of developing a management plan with all the stakeholders, the scientific community, the original partners in the Oyster Heritage Program, as staff has suggested, then I think we have a blueprint and a framework that will allow us to move forward and manage the harvest areas in a sensible way and in an open way. I think one of the problems we're dealing with here is a problem of history. We started out with a plan. The plan was to have small one-acre reefs that would be larval production engines for adjacent harvest areas, 25-acre harvest areas adjacent to those sites. And unfortunately, the commission, after a year or two of just developing the project, short-circuited the entire plan because they allowed harvesting upriver of the bridge. And in doing that, we've been put into this defensive posture now with what's left below the bridge. And it doesn't constitute a sound management plan. I think as we move forward with the management plan, you know, a key component has to be that managers and the industry and the harvesters have a clear understanding of how we're going to allow harvest. As the resource recovers, if it does, and we hope it will, we need to be clear in terms of how and where and when harvesting is going to be allowed. That can be accomplished with triggers or thresholds or whatever other triggers need to be in place, at which point harvesting would be allowed, or perhaps rotational models. There are a number of different ways in which that can be done, but that needs to be clearly communicated. Either they're open to harvest all the time and they're simply harvest areas, or they're harvestable when densities reach a certain threshold. But that is not something this commission can do in 30 days. That's something that has to go through a development process. I think we can have it in place by next year if we work diligently towards that end. But I think harvesting in the area that's closed now without that in place would not be wise. And consequently, that's where I think we need to move.
Well, when the watermen came forward last month and asked for the possibility, considering certain market conditions, certain seasonal closures that the Commonwealth of Virginia had no impact over, the supply that's direly needed for the industry, as I said to Dr. Mann, I thought it would be in the best interest that we look into it, we examine it. Also knowing full well that the Blue Ribbon Oyster Panel is working, and as vice chair of that with Secretary Bryant, I am committed and dedicated to seeing that process through, and I'm relying on the best scientists and watermen and all facets of the impacted community, including the public, have a right to be protected, or the resource to be protected, or the public trust doctrine, to come together and formulate a composite plan. Now, had something come out of the evaluations during the past month conducted by my staff and conducted by the Virginia Institute of Marine Science that would have been a epiphany, for lack of a better term, that would have allowed limited harvest and not be detrimental to the overall workings of the Blue Ribbon Panel, certainly I would support some type of limited harvest. But at this juncture, based on the information that I have received and considering the continued works of the Blue Ribbon Panel, I just cannot at this juncture support an opening of the Rappahannock or the Tribbs. It pains me to say that. It's the first decision that I have made as commissioner that will negatively impact a lot of my friends and a lot of people that have worked hard with me through the years. But sometimes you have to do what you believe is right, not the easy thing, and that's where I stand today. The matter is before the commission for action. Mr. Bowden.
I think this is going to be a moot point, but I still believe we ought to move forward. I understand what everybody says. I'm in a unique position. I'm the only person up here that ever oystered. I've seen tremendous spat sets. I have seen all the oysters you want, 2.5 to 3 inches. Going to have the best season it ever was. And come August, they're all dead. It doesn't discriminate against just 3-inch oysters. It will kill a 6-inch oyster just as well as will a 3. When the event happens, it happens. So, you know, I can understand why everybody feels the way they do. I have no animosity against anybody. So, you know, Dr. Mann told me some people got mad. I don't. I never take none of this personally. I think everybody's probably striving to do the best job they can on both sides of the fence. In a case where we have hard, credible science, there's no doubt in my mind we need to go with science. In this case, that's lacking. There's disagreement among and in the scientific community about what's happening and what's not happening. So in a case like that, I think what you do is you proceed carefully. I think what Mr. Kellum suggested, modified by what Mr. Fox said, changing the line, is being cautious. I want you to understand when the infrastructure is gone, it's gone. Nobody's going to build any kind of a seafood processing plant anymore. Land is way too valuable. You would never get your money back. Some of the places home that supported the Oyster House have sold a neighborhood $8 or $10 million. Nobody's going to make an investment in $8 or $10 million worth of land because the future's not there, period. You know, we're global now. We're not just, you know, before we were kind of geographic. You had to worry about what the West Coast or the Gulf did. Now we worry about what happens in the world. I think this is a chance that I'm certainly willing to take. So I would like to put forth the motion that we accept Mr. Kellum's plan with the change in boundaries, but with the harvest limits and stuff suggested at the last meeting. And that would be my proposal.
Motion made by Mr. Bowden.
I'll second that motion.
Seconded by Mr. Holland. Any further?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I appreciate what's been done by industry to put this proposal together. It was thoughtful. I think behind it is the notion that the status quo is unacceptable, and I wholeheartedly agree with that. I agree with that economically. I agree with that biologically. I think we have to do better than what we're doing. But I think the way to do that is with a new management plan, rather than moving forward with harvest in this area. I think what's left in this area has a greater value economically and ecologically if it's used in restoration rather than simply harvesting. I think if we come up with a management plan that includes new sanctuary areas, we could pay the industry to harvest the product to relocate it to sanctuary reefs possibly. But it would be premature to do that before a management plan has been developed and put in place. And I would offer a substitute motion at this point of staff recommendation modified to include instructions that the commissioner invite the Oyster Heritage Program to reconvene for the purpose of redesigning the sanctuary system and developing a management plan for the Lower Rappahannock.
Is there a second to the substitute motion?
Second.
Seconded by Mr. Tankard. The vote is on the substitute motion. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Yes, I'm sorry.
We have an explanation of what we're voting on here. We're voting to not open the harvest.
That's correct. We're voting to accept staff recommendations as previously published in your
plus the addition of
plus the addition of the Oyster Heritage Program being reconvened to address the sanctuary matter. Motion made by Mr. Robbins, seconded by Mr. Tankard. Any further discussion on the substitute motion? All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
Nay. Yeah.
The motion, substitute motion to accept staff recommendations made by Mr. Robbins, seconded by Mr. Tankard. Mr. Bowden?
No.
Mr. Fox?
Aye.
Mr. Holland?
No.
Dr. McConaughey?
Aye.
Mr. McCleskey is absent. Mr. Robbins?
Aye.
Mr. Schick?
No.
Mr. Tankard?
Aye.
Chair votes yes. Motion passed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to 1, 2, 3 to accept staff recommendations. Thank you all for a very good presentation.
Yes, the staff recommendation.
Next item on the agenda is item number 20. Thank you. What do we have? I'm sorry.
We added somebody.
Man's Ernie just left to go to the bathroom.
There's nine to begin with, and one's missing, so there's eight.
Mr. Bowden just left to go to the bathroom. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Chair voted. I voted. Yes, sir. Vote every time. Vote every time. Next item is item 19. Request for public hearing, Mr. Travelstead.
This item comes to you partly as the result of discussions with the Department of Game and Inland Fisheries. There is regulation 4 VAC 15-360 makes it unlawful to use a gill net to harvest freshwater fish in the state. Well, that regulation is not a VMRC regulation. It's a Game Department regulation. Now, on the other side of the jurisdiction, VMRC sells recreational gill net licenses that can be used in all tidal waters. And as you know, the upriver portions of those tidal waters are freshwater areas. So there's a little bit of, I wouldn't say overlap, but there are two jurisdictional issues that affect fisheries in the freshwater tidal portions of our rivers. On the one hand, VMRC licenses and allows the use of gear to catch fishes in those areas, and on the other hand, the Game Department has regulations that prohibit the harvest of freshwater fishes.
Is this part of the debate same areas? Said Mr. Wyatt and Mr. Whitney?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. One of the things that the Game Department is in the process of amending their regulation to allow recreational gill nets to harvest gizzard shad and white perch. They agree that there should be fisheries for those species and are amending their regulations to allow it in accordance with VMRC regulation. Now, having done that, they are